I would like to inform all parties the call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you.
Thanks, operator. So welcome, everybody. This is our now second HSTLD quote-unquote technical call. The nature of this call is that it rose out of a request from the advisory group several weeks ago to break the call into sort of two components, or break our efforts into two components. One for sort of overall program issues, direction of program and program content, and one call focusing on sort of the more technical and control-based aspects of the program. So hopefully everyone's got the agenda, and as I was speaking about earlier, we'll be drawing a little bit from Adobe Connect today. So to the extent that you have access, please join in on Adobe Connect. Before we begin, though, I'm going to take a quick roll call and then ask if anyone's got any amendments to the agenda. So please tell me if you don't. I've got Michael Blage, Barbara Bellis,
yep.
Eric Brenner-Williams, David Piscatello, Simon McCalla, Mikey O'Connor, Stephen Pack, and Brian Cute. Did I miss anybody? All right. Does anybody have any desire to review or amend the agenda before we begin? I'll take that as a no. Okay, with that, I'm going to open up the little Adobe Connect to a full screen here, and I see it's going to block my chat. I'm not sure if I'll be able to fix that.
I was telling you earlier, the chat across the bottom is probably the least presenter and the presentees.
I'll give this a whirl here. That's about as good as I'm going to be able to get it. Unfortunately, I apologize. I just, again, I'm not an Adobe connector here. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go back and forth between this view and an overall view, just so that I can give everyone an overview of what sort of the current draft of the control worksheet looks like. For those of you unfamiliar, so up on the HSTLD wiki page is a version of the HSTLD controls. This is a slightly modified version, and I haven't posted it to the wiki yet. I wanted to discuss it a little bit on today's call and use it as a potential for updating the material on the wiki. If you look at the differences between the two, the content itself is the same. What I've done, and this is somewhat significant, is I've broken up the content into two columns, and I'm trying to go back and forth. Hopefully you can kind of see what I'm illustrating here. On the left, we have the HSTLD standard objectives and criteria. That column goes through each principle and its corresponding objectives, topics, criteria. And there's an additional column here that numbers each criteria. On the right, what we've got is illustrative control examples. These illustrative examples, the important concept here is that these are controls that organizations may actually change or have their own version that we have content that is standards objectives criteria. This is the standards area. And over here, this is just guidance with some control examples to help a TLD build an appropriate control environment.
Andy, this is Palais. Just a real quick question. Just the title. I thought we were going to leave it more vague. You still have HSTLD certification program. I thought we were just going to call it the HSTLD program. And
you're right. You know, I did. You know, I've got that update already done. This version that I have up on Adobe Connect is from last week, Mike. That's all.
Okay, not a problem. Just
okay.
I did actually
catch that. Yeah.
Okay.
So the other change that I'm trying to cut through by this week is, for those that are familiar with existing control environment guidance, this HSTLD criteria column, I'm breaking another column down into a bit more objective control-based language or actionable language, because the way it is now, sort of, it gives the reader overall idea of what we're looking for, but it's not objective-based. So I've got a new version coming out. I'll post it on either Friday or Monday to the wiki that will have more objective control-based language. So those are the changes that I've got now in this draft versus what's up on the wiki. Again, the concept of the principles, the topics, the objectives, the criteria, and all these illustrative examples is virtually the same material that we have up on the wiki. I'm going to just check to make sure we don't have any chat stuff going on. Okay. And Eric, I'll fix my understanding of how this works for next call. I apologize, it's a little bit wonky now. I'm still learning it. So on last week's call, we went through principle number one. And the strategy of going through was to start with the principle and then really talk about each of the criteria, the objectives and the criteria, and very quickly go over some of the standard criteria, so the stuff where I could draw from outside references like ISO or other references. We really quickly glossed over those illustrative control examples. We spent more time talking about the NA controls because they're much more centric to the TLD environment, whereas some of the other stuff is referenceable or controls that are available from outside entities. So I'm going to try to take a similar approach to today's call for principles 2 and 3. We'll get through as much as we get through, obviously. And I'd ask that if anyone has any sort of pre-questions on the on any of the illustrative control examples as we go through, please just get in queue, and we'll go through the questions as we go. So the idea of principle number 2 is that the registry maintains effective controls to provide reasonable assurance that the processing of core registry functions are authorized, accurate, complete, and performed in a timely manner in accordance with established policies and standards. The identity of participating entities is established and authenticated. So that's sort of the principle that we're trying to support. Within that, what we're saying is, the first thing we're saying here in 2.1 is that registry security we're looking at registry security verification. And registry operator credentials are made available to substantiate the identity of the legal entity that operates the TLD. So our first little control area here deals with the vetting of registry organization under 2.1.1. And we have one of our little NAs right off the bat here. And that NA is, so not available, what that means is not available. I didn't have a control reference that I could reference for this. So it's more a more specific TLD-based control that we had to generate from scratch. So I definitely would like feedback here. The illustrative control example is that the HSTLD sponsor should verify whether the background of the principals for the candidate registry operator are made available on the website or on request. And the notes we have here, the background should include summary of experience, employment, professional history, professional accreditations, and professional associations. Do I have any feedback on that particular illustrative control example?
Yes, actually, Craig. You used the word sponsor for the HSTLD applicant.
Yeah, that's exactly the type of feedback I'm looking for. Is that the right language?
That's dead language. We don't have sponsor TLDs anymore.
Okay.
We have applicants, which may be United Gangsters of Chicago, or they might be Bank of America, no difference. But they're just simple applicants. There's no sponsors.
Should it just be the high security zone should verify? Because it's the high security zone TLD. The only reason I'm raising this question, Eric, is that I definitely agree with your point,
Michael,
about
stop.
This.
Michael, stop and restart. I got cut off by the phone people who thought I was making too much noise because I've got canaries near me or something.
Okay, no problem. To restart, I agree with your concept that the use of the word sponsor there is potentially misleading, particularly because that term is no longer used going forward in the DAG. That being said, this program is supposed to scale for not only new GTLDs but also existing GTLDs. So perhaps I agree, we'll strike the word sponsor, but would the appropriate term not be the high security zone TLD, just the TLD itself? Or are we looking at the registry operator, the registry infrastructure provider? Whose credentials are we looking at?
This question was directed to the status of the applicant. Now, you may want to look past the applicant to any of the contracted parties that the applicant proposes in their application or that subsequently adds to the operation of the registry when it gets past the contract phase and into delegation phase and operation phase. So you may want to look to, as far away as their accountants, but at least in the first instance, we're concerned with the applicants themselves.
But I guess what I'm saying is if you just say if you use the term high security zone TLD, if you just leave it at that, you don't leave the limitation of applicant or limitation of infrastructure provider or anything like that. If you use the high security zone TLD, I think that's the biggest umbrella to encompass registry operator, infrastructure provider. I think that would probably be the best approach. I just offer that as a suggestion. I mean, Andy or Dave, are we trying to throw the biggest net possible, or are we trying to be myopic in the approach here?
The idea here is really, if you look a little bit to the right, that and I'll put the little hand over here. This is about the background of the principles of the TLD. And so what we're trying to say is, as an organization, and this might work, I think, to your suggestion, we're trying to get a comfort that the background of the principles is known and good in public, if you will.
Right, but that's a surface model that we call the TLD, which is distinct from the applicant.
Right.
Goes
exactly, Eric.
Right.
I'm sorry, Eric, I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm just agreeing because I think that's the right road to go down. And my question is, what's the right language for that?
Well, Michael suggested the HSTLD. Personally, I think that applicant is sufficient. And if we need to look past the applicant, because we're dealing with this not just as a – it's not static in time. That is,
right.
We're interested in the applicant the day that they file their application, the day that contract is negotiated, the day of delegation, we're interested in that trajectory of this thing, which results in the service model that we call a high security top-level domain. So if we're going to look to humans and their agency and their actions, we need to look to the applicant, at least, not to the service model.
Right. So, in other words, whoever applied for the TLD would be covered with that language.
Yeah.
But again, not trying to be difficult here, but since this is supposed to scale and be applicable to existing registry operators, what happens if an Afilias or a VeriSign or a Neustar, would they then be an applicant when they're already the designated registry operator?
Well, they're an applicant for this thing, whatever the heck it is.
Right. I actually like that language because we're a qualifying applicant with HSTLD, so it's the HSTLD applicant, not the TLD applicant, right? I think that works. Are you okay with that, Mike?
I think so. As I said, I just want to make sure that this has scalability going forward and back. That's all I'm looking, you know, from an engineering standpoint. That's the purity I'm looking for.
Yeah, no, these are all good questions. I think this field, the applicant does it. It nails it, I think.
I'll have to quote you on that sometime, Michael.
On the purity? Yeah, there you go. Sometimes
right.
Lawyers tend
okay,
to like borders.
This is Brian. Can I get in the queue? I'll be really quick, and I'm not trying to beat a dead horse here. Just let's be conscious that on the policy side of this discussion, I'm pretty sure there was a common approach that the HSTLD process be treated as a parallel process to the new TLD process, and that we just don't want to create any confusion that the applicant here refers to the new TLD process. Just as long as we respect and make clear those two parallel processes, then I think we're fine with the title.
You know what I could do? I could put in quotes, the distinction between TLD applicant or and HSTLD applicant, or just leave it open as the HSTLD should verify. I'll tell you what, for the next revision, I'll use HSTLD applicant, and we'll push it up there with that information, and everyone have a look at it, and we can use email to sort of back and forth on the thoughts on it.
Okay.
Now, that language, if we sort of bring that thought down, the rest of the vetting criteria use that language, so obviously I'll flip to HSTLD applicant to each of these. These controls that fall after the first NA on this page, we drew from WebTrust Extended Verification 1.1, and they talk about, again, the sponsor should identify and verify the background of at least one principal individual associated with the candidate registry operator, and we give some examples there. The HSTLD, I'm going to say now, I'll start using applicant even though it says sponsor. The HSTLD applicant should verify whether the identified principal individual or the candidate registry operators, so again, there's some samples, is not located in a country where it is prohibited from doing business. And those three areas address the overall control of the background of the principals.
Now, you're taking from the WebTrust ED 1.1 here, but there's, again, just as the comment that's been made previously, there's no correlation between this and what's currently in DAG-D. We don't know which of these, if any, actually extends the meaning if it's contained in DAG-D3 for the qualifications of an applicant.
Correct. That's correct, Eric.
Yeah, I wish we could...
Hello?
Stop doing that.
In other words, you want to have a really detailed look at DAG and
every time we delve off the DAG, I want to know it.
Right.
It is the service model that we're chasing, is deltas off the DAG.
Okay. I'm going to take that as a to-do, and my plan there would be to sit down with the DAG team at ICANN and just quickly go through. When we get this sort of first rev looked at by everybody, go through with the DAG group and on each of these controls, try to mark where the DAG may have coverage.
Yep.
I think that'll get you what you want, Eric. And
yep. You could delete everything that's already in the DAG, which would be a great picture of whatever is left.
Let's talk about that for just a minute. The danger in doing that. So one of the things that the HSTLD program would do that's different from the DAG. So the DAG looks at requirements at a point in time and then potentially doesn't look at those controls for quite a while, if ever, after.
Correct.
The HSTLD program would presumably put much more discipline about a regular refresh of these controls so that you could maintain your HSTLD status. So even if the controls were in DAG, I think it's important to keep them in here to keep that discipline.
Well, we have to keep temporal property here that says we feed every 6 months.
Right.
Then, but that doesn't mean repeat, you know, it doesn't mean restate the entire verbiage that's in DAG. It just does, you know, whatever is in the DAG gets refreshed every 6 months or whenever. Then if
oh,
there's any
I
addition
saying,
to that.
Yeah, get the control verbiage from DAG.
Yeah, and if we have anything in addition to that, like does the vice president smoke or is he left-handed, that thing, which is not in the DAG, is clearly here, as well as the everything that's in the DAG gets refreshed every 6 months.
Okay.
So I want to see the delta in the formal specification, and then I'd also like to see the temporal property. That is, this is not just one snapshot, but it's an ongoing or repeated evaluation, or the status that has to be maintained.
Right, to maintain your HSTLD, whatever it is, whether it's a seal or a report card or whatever, you'd have to go through.
But we don't know what it is yet, but it's a status. It's not a one-time check.
Right. You know, so my challenge is to not only to get this material together, the control material together, but also to get sort of a briefing memo pulled together of some of the either the decisions, basically a description of the HSTLD program, and some of the things will obviously be open. You know, we haven't decided on some of the things. That temporal question, I think it's important to have a temporal aspect. We just haven't decided what the frequency is, right? So I can put in there that the group is thinking about a temporal aspect, but we don't have agreement on frequency and so forth. But, you know, that's one of the things we're focusing on.
Good.
Okay.
The question, Brian, for the queue.
I guess I'm... Mike, do you want me to maintain the queue, or do you want to maintain the queue?
I'm sorry, I was on mute. Yeah, go ahead.
I'll maintain the queue. Go ahead, Brian. You're in queue, and you're the first one.
Okay, just stepping back for a second, and I'm referring back to the thread of conversation in the other part of this working group's meetings. The notion that the HSTLD process will be distinct and parallel to and separate from the application process. There was some discussion that the DAG would have at most just a passing reference to the program. Are we changing our idea or recommendations about what elements of this get incorporated into the DAG and how, or is that a commonly held view that all that's necessary is a passing reference as this thing gets built in parallel?
Brian, that's a great question. Let me give you as precise an answer as I can. So I've been trying to lock that down, too, because at the end of the day, I participate in coming up with a lot of the content, right? So I want to make sure my content meets expectation.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversations that I've had, there are two things that are desired to produce for DAG version 4. The first is a control template, basically this material, that we can say the group has reviewed. There may be updates to, as HSTLD group, we should reserve the right to continually monitor and maintain this in some way because, you know, as the needs of controls change, our materials change accordingly, right? But there should be, at least be some initial Rev 1, if you will, of the control standard. Now, the control standards themselves do not influence the application process. They're a reference within DAG, and the reason that that's important is that this high security zone TLD program is one of the programs that has been undertaken to deal with the overarching issue of malicious conduct. So it's important to show progress there, and it's important to show that we've got a community focus on this. But controls are not meant to directly influence the content. It's merely sort of a reference in a part of the DAG. Now, in order to do that, we also then need, in addition to this control structure, sort of a memo that describes the program. And those are the two artifacts that would make their way into the DAG. They're not, again, they're not part of the application process. They're not directly linked. It's a reference area for the program so that we can show that the program has been initiated, is producing, you know, these types of things, and it helps us deal with malicious conduct. I don't know, Dave Piscitello, I don't know if you're available to make sure that I'm accurate with that, but that's my current understanding. I don't know if we'll get Dave. He may be on mute. Brian, does that answer your question? That's as detailed as I can get it.
Yeah, and I appreciate the fact, Andy, that you're really just passing on conversations that you've heard from the staff, and that staff would be driving most of these decisions. That being said, it raises two questions. Has staff said whether or not these passing references to the program would be subject to public comment as part of DAG 4 or not?
Everything's subject to public comment.
Right, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, what I would expect is we're going to get feedback on this. We being the high security group would get feedback on this, which is a good thing, because at the end of the day, we want to make sure that our material is being commented and improving through the community process. So I think that's a good thing. I don't know if there's a bad aspect to that. I think it's a chance for us to say, we've had a pass through this. The group that is on the HSTLD AG obviously represent the entire community. So if we get some feedback, positive or negative, we can take that into account as we build the program.
I don't think there's a negative aspect to that. I'm trying to keep my eye on the ball. The question of, is this going to become part of the TLD application process in a formal way, or is it going to be truly separately tracked? That's what I'm trying to get a sense of.
Go ahead, Andy. Go ahead. I have a question to answer in the queue, but you go first, please.
Okay. Yeah. I've been trying to track that as well, and my the answer that I've got back from ICANN staff, so Kurt Pritz and on down, is that there's no desire to make this part of the application process. One of the things that the board has sort of asked is there's sort of four overarching issues related to the new GTLD program in general. One of them is malicious conduct. Within malicious conduct, I think there's 10 activities that were highlighted. This is one of those activities. So the desire is to show that malicious conduct as an overarching issue has been responded to, and there are programs and appropriate activities in place to try to make the world better, I guess is the best way to put it. But there's no linkage of this material into the application process.
Pardon me for interrupting, but which specific of the 10 elements within the malicious conduct point within the four overarching issues in the IRQ report is the high security TLD AG address?
Supposed to be addressing? Eric, I'm going to have to get back to you on that. Is that okay?
Yeah, but I need to know the exact thing.
I'm just taking it down so I don't lose track here. Will do. When I know, I can push that out on the email group, too.
So, Andy, this is Palage. Just two points to respond to, Brian's comments. One, it has to be a parallel, independent process, because otherwise how would existing registries be able to apply for this? And that, to me, is one of the things that has always stood out in the original straw man paper, that this was not just for new GTLDs but existing registries as well. So I guess that's point one. With regard to point two, which I also agree with Brian about how we would provide more feedback, I think one of the things that we're going to be discussing on the second part of the call today is the concept of an RFI and how we're going to solicit feedback from other, if you will, potential vendors to run this program. So based upon that feedback, as well as the feedback from the comments in connection with DAG 4, I think that is going to be the data sets upon how we will refine this information. So I'm agreeing with Brian on those points, and is my correction, is my assumptions there correct, Andy?
I think so, yeah. I mean, again, I channel ICANN staff to the best I can. That's totally my understanding, though, and my expectation, yes. And you know, as the guy that sort of wrote that original concept paper, you're right, Mike. One of the things that was very clear is that the work of this program should be available to any TLD at any time, because at the end of the day, it's meant to, you know, provide a good structure for control for any of the TLDs. Okay, I'm going to start looking at the next little piece here, which also falls under Registry of Registry Organization. It's called Verifiable Address. Fairly stuff. The note is that the physical address of the place of business could be maintained on the entity's website or could also be provided separately on request. I started here rather than over here to give a little context. We're really looking to basically be able to assign a way to communicate and an address to the registry. And similar, again, WebTrust EV has some good language around this. So the two controls here are that sponsors should verify the physical address of the place of business for the candidate registry operator. Now, again, I think registry operator is the right language to use here, but I may have got that wrong. And then the HSTLD, I'm going to start using that applicant. The HSTLD applicant should obtain reasonable assurance about the physical existence and business presence of the candidate registry operator. Is that registry operator term kind of
yeah,
right?
Yeah, not completely.
Okay.
ICANN treats registry operator as meaning the party that has a contract with ICANN. I work for CORE. We operate two registries, but we don't have a contract with CORE, I mean with ICANN. So
okay. This
language wouldn't apply to entities like CORE.
Okay.
So you could hypothetically have the First Bank of Mars, which consists of one guy living on the Cayman Islands.
Right.
But are you really interested in where he resides, or are you interested in where the registry actually is? Which of these two properties are you interested in? The fiction or the formal contracting party, or the actual place where the registry backend is operated?
Let me turn that around, Eric, to a question, and I apologize for doing this, but it'll help me understand.
All right.
The nature of the control, or the reason for the control, is that should action need to take place, whether ICANN needs to reach out to the organization to inform them that something bad is happening, or you know, to be able to contact the right entity to make things happen at the right times.
We have a local example of that.
Do I have a what?
There's a lovely example of that. During the conflict, we needed to get a hold of the registry operator for the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
You got it.
Or any of us thought of it. We
you
never,
got it. That's it.
We finally found him in Singapore.
Well, that is exactly what we're trying to fix with this control.
Okay, then we don't want to talk about the registry operator because that's the guy living in Switzerland.
Okay.
We want to talk about the registry operator and the registry back-end services provider.
Okay, so I'll add that.
But Eric, don't you want to include both? Because
I just said both, Mike.
Okay, I'm sorry then. Thanks.
Okay.
Let me make sure I got this language correct. It's the registry operator and the back-end service provider.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks a bunch for that insight, Eric, too. And that's exactly what this control is trying to deal with. Okay. The final one here is the registry applicant should verify that the business candidate and we'll say registry operator and back-end service provider's place of business is not in a country where it is prohibited from doing business. So, again, these things seem like motherhood and apple pie and simple things, if you will, but in that corn – exactly to your point, Eric, in that corn ficker issue, had these controls been in place, the reaction time would have been greatly reduced probably.
Yep.
Awesome.
So let me ask you this question. The HSTLD sponsor should verify is not in the country where it is prohibited from doing business. I guess, I don't want to go legal here, but considering that a registry provides service to registrants and registries around the world, that seems like somewhat of a mighty burden, particularly when you have laws that are constantly evolving right now. I mean, China has actually recently proposed restrictions and obligations on telecommunication and infrastructure providers to turn over data to the state if they think it raises to a level of national security. So,
So, Mike, on this one, this is about the place of business. And it's to scope this right. It's to provide that think of it with that corn ficker lens on that Eric mentioned. That's perfect. It's to provide a contactable person or contactable reference so that actions can be taken. And it's about doing business in that locale, that country.
As I said, I'm not going to slow this down, but off list, I will show you where some courts have taken different views as to where a registry is engaged in business with not exactly consistent results. But I don't want to slow down this part. I'll take that up off list.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a bunch, Mike. And you may be somebody that can help me fix this a little bit if it needs to be fixed. Okay.
Brian, back in the queue.
Go ahead, Brian. Yep.
Sorry, guys. Just want to make sure I heard something correctly. Are we suggesting that back-end registry services providers should be HSTLDs? And if so, can you just walk through? I mean, I understand the problem, Eric, that you described of finding the right resources under that control, and the back-end provider can be one of those. But is the suggestion that the back-end should be HSTLD qualified, certified, or report carded, whatever the case may be?
The suggestion would be that the it's up to the HSTLD applicant. If that applicant desires their TLD to be HSTLD verified, then they need to make sure that they're doing business with a back-end provider that can provide the specific controls that HSTLD applicant is responsible for. That doesn't necessarily mean they need to have all of the controls in place, but for these specific controls that say that we've got to verify place of business or those types of items, then yes, that service provider would need to comply with those controls for the applicant that they're supporting.
And I understand that. I'm just walking through the mechanics of it, though. Would it not be that the registry operator, the front end, applies for HSTLD certification, approval, recognition, whatever the case turns out to be, and is the HSTLD registry operator, and then contracts with a back-end provider, and through that contract includes requirements that the back-end satisfy all the necessary controls. I'm not trying to be too mechanical here, but it's important.
No, and that's mechanically how I would expect it to happen. So there's a lot of other sort of models that we can look to that work today that would be similar to this. Like, for instance, PCI and HIPAA compliance, for instance, there are control requirements that need to be in place for credit card processing, right? So not all that is done in-house for a lot of credit card processors. In fact, it's quite common that there are service providers that provide support for those types of activities. And in the case of those types of certifications, the service providers need to be compliant for those controls. So contractually, yeah, I think what you'd probably do as an operator is make sure your contract was written in such a way that you have comfort that those controls would be done. And then from a existence of controls perspective, you'd also have to make sure that your contract was structured so that whoever's auditing or checking for the controls would have the ability to either get a report from that service provider stating the control was in place from a third party, or, you know, the ability to audit directly the control.
I have to
say
that
thank you.
This wouldn't have helped us if we had just said that it was our ability to close, to find out where the actual operation of the .EC was done, depended upon the contractual relationship between ICANN, the DC, not the contract, but the delegated party, and then any contract between a delegee and the ultimate operator. So while I appreciate Brian's interest in distinguishing between the registry operator or the contracted party with ICANN and the registry backend services provider, the non-contracted party with ICANN, if we use contracts as our only tool, we're going to have situations exist like we had with ERC.
Right. What will end up happening, and I've seen this too, not necessarily with the TLD space, but with other spaces like PCI, like HIPAA, you can creatively create contracts to actually make a barrier to discovering what you need.
Yeah.
I guess that's the right way to put it.
I think that's what lawyers do.
Yeah. I mean, and in
liability
fact,
listing.
Right. That's right. And in fact, this control is trying to make a structure that would discourage that practice.
Right.
All right. Any other questions for the queue? Okay. I'm going to take 5 minutes and try to quickly go through the rest of these verifiable email and telephone because they're pretty much the same theme. So the next two are the verifiable email address and verifiable telephone number. The HSTLD applicant should verify the candidate registry operator and service provider's email address and validate whether it is monitored and designated as the main email address for the candidate registry operator's business. And the HSTLD applicant should verify the candidate registry operator's phone number and validate whether it is designated as the main phone number for the candidate registry operator's business. Again, this is all about what I'll call reachability. In the case of bad acting and horrible things going on, we want to make sure that these high security guys at least are reachable and can be called upon to take action rapidly. Okay, any questions on that? I'm going to try to cut through articles of incorporation quickly, although I'm not a lawyer, so I may have missed some things here. The next four controls are around articles of incorporation, and they're about the HSTLD applicant should verify whether the articles of incorporation of the candidate registry operator, and I think we say again, and service provider, specify the purpose of the organization, organization's name, place of business, and key officers. I have a question mark there because I don't think there's any more that we'd want to look at, but I'm always willing to, you know, if I'm missing any key point there, you know, that would have helped, for instance, in Kornficker or something, you know, definitely let's raise that and get that in. The other three come from WebTrust EV, which again has a great construct for how to look at this level of control. And it talks about the HSTLD applicant should verify whether the candidate registry operator is a legally recognized entity whose existence was created by filing with the incorporating or registry agency in its jurisdiction of incorporation or registration. The HSTLD applicant should verify whether the candidate registry operator has designated with the incorporating or registration agency either registered agent, a registered office as required under the laws of the jurisdiction of incorporation or registration, or equivalent facility. And then finally, the HSTLD applicant should verify whether the candidate registry operator is designated as an inactive, invalid, non-current organization or equivalent in records of the incorporating agency or registration agency. So I just cut through that really quickly. But the idea on this one is checking out the sort of the legitimacy of the articles of incorporation behind those entities. Does anybody have any questions there? I know, Mike, you may have some specific viewpoint there that I just don't know, not being a lawyer. I think I got it covered, but then again, you know, I could be missing some big pieces here. Okay. With that, we have you know, a few more areas on section two here, and I think it's a logical break point for now. We didn't get through two and three. That's fine. Two and three are what you'll see is two and three are very similar. So principles two and principles three, they have a different lens. One is about the registry and one is about the registrar. I think if we can get the registry stuff right, it will go through the registrar stuff much more quickly. And then principle number four is fairly small. So I don't think we're making too bad progress. What I would encourage the group to do between now and our next conversation is really look at the controls. I'll update the spreadsheet and the wiki, like I said, either Friday or Monday with this material. And let's start using email as a dialogue to further and to better the controls as well, in addition to this call.
Andy, this is Stephen Pack, if I can get in the queue.
Sure, Stephen, go ahead. Actually, that's what I'm going to do for the next 5 minutes. I'm just going to open it up for general. Go ahead.
I've been following, you know, the wiki side of this, and of course, what you presented today is limited in appearance or presentation. But I see the references to ISO 27002. I saw your references to SysTrust, WebTrust. But when you got further down into the systems, I didn't see you using SysTrust. Is there a reason?
There's no specific reason other than we just picked the. You know, in the trust services sort of suite, we just picked the first one that we were familiar with.
Okay, I mean, because
when
you get into SysTrust, you talk about security, availability, processing integrity, and maintainability. I mean, those are the four major points within SysTrust. If you're talking about security for, as I understand the background of this, for banking and so forth, this is one that they like to see. I mean, I personally, we're going through SAS 70s. I've also looked into all these other things for other areas. I'm an old auditor, so, you know, that's the only reason why I ask why this one was omitted.
It wasn't by design, you know. So we tried to get two things done. I mean, just to give you a background, I don't know if you know my background. I'm actually from KPMG, so I resemble an auditor every so often, although I'm more in the advisory, so the consulting-type practice. So I deal with this stuff fairly often, and we wanted to make sure that we got as much of an international control view as we could. So we drew a lot from the ISO standards because they're more international based. The web and the SysTrust stuff, although it's sort of endorsed by the AICPA and the Canadian accountant group, it's not as internationally focused. I mean, it's a great resource, and I did try to draw from it as much as I could, but we tried to balance as much as we could between coverage internationally, coverage with the right control environment, and this is sort of the structure that we came up with. Appreciate, though, this is just an illustrative control example. Organizations want to come up with their own controls. They could have something very different from what we've drawn up here. This is just to provide guidance to those organizations that are interested in the program.
Okay, so are you saying that the goal of the HSTLD is to provide a guidance, or if this is a certification, why wouldn't they be providing the parameters under which to be certified?
Okay, so we are doing both. If you look at, and actually the trust services breaks it down, I believe, like this too. To the left, this is the sort of in the beginning of the dialogue, I talked about the spreadsheet in terms of left and right. The left side is all about the actual standards. I'm clarifying the criteria to be more objective-based, so they're more control language-based. There'll be another column here very shortly, Friday or Monday. And this stuff on the left side is really the standard.
Right.
The material on the right side here are illustrative control examples, and frequently in the trust services realm, when you go and you look at a trust services, a client that's trying to get, you know, a web trust or a SysTrust trust, they'll have a lot of the controls that are stated right out of the illustrative control examples, but they'll also have some of their own that they feel are good enough and meet the requirement of the criteria. So what I'm saying is the stuff on the right here really is I wouldn't call it elective, but it's an illustrative example of a control.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, I understand what you're saying there, but as I read through them, I see what you're saying, that they're a suggested control. But on the other hand, as an ex-auditor, both of us, you remember we had an audit program that said, okay, you're supposed to have this document, and then you have to test. You have to test that that document is being followed. I mean, here you're stating certain things, but you're not making it a finite, verifiable procedure.
Yes, and the tie there, I think the tie that you're talking about, so when I talk about an objective criteria, that's what I mean by objective. It's a testable criteria. I'm trying to modify this language here on the left side with something that is specifically testable.
Okay, but I mean, I don't want to prolong this, but last comment. But what I read here is basically it says, okay, you will provide this. I see a checkbox, but where? I mean, the check the box aspect of it, but where is the verification that it's being followed, that the procedure is being followed? So in plain words, you have a procedure in place, yes. Now, how do you test to verify that for a certification?
Right. In other words, so you want the audit program that goes with this?
Yes.
Okay. I gotcha. I don't think we're going to get to the point where we actually write an audit program. I could be wrong. That could be the advisory group may make that as a recommendation. But that's certainly out there. I mean, I think I hear what you're saying. You want to look at the audit program. This is not meant to be that. This is meant to be more of the criteria and the objectives.
Okay, but if let's say a PwC or Grant Thornton wants to come in to be one of the independent third-party verifiers, they're going to have standards by which to work in which to certify this. Is that not correct?
That is correct. And one of the things we're talking about in the overall advisory group is what I call the quality of the assessor. So what does it take to even be a third-party assessor? And we haven't really talked a lot about that. We've given some thoughts about it, but that's a significant portion as well for all these types of programs. They need to have some level of qualification, and part of that qualification would be their ability to create an audit program sufficient for the program, right?
Correct. I mean, there has to be a standard by which these third parties have to perform.
Correct.
Whether it's ISO, it's ISO, it's WebTrust, it's SysTrust, or whatever, but it's got to be something that's a meld of all three, since you're really not using one of them.
Right. Well, what it is, this is the structure that we're putting together to be that, and it draws from all of those programs.
Okay. Just Andy, Steve, just to interrupt for a second, it's now the top of the hour. I think we have... Are other people going to join this bridge, or do we have to dial into another bridge and continue this conversation there?
You know, that's a great question. Let me just check the bridge numbers here. I didn't actually ever check. I think they're the same, but let me confirm here. Show them as the same number, Mike. I don't know what happens if I don't hang up and keep going.
Well, what happens is let's just keep going, and 10 minutes in, if we don't have any new people, we'll see what happens. I didn't want to disrupt that good flow between you and Steve, but
yeah, that's a great question.
Excuse me, sir. This is the conference coordinator.
Hi.
We also have another call with the same passcode. We have 11 parties in that at this time, so you would need to disconnect and call back in.
Okay.
Thank you.
And
all right, then.
Okay. Hang up and dial back in. Take it easy, guys.
I'll be on in a few minutes. Bye now.